Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. So today's guest writes on important issues, especially around women and in particular, working class women who face challenges and have to make daily choices that most of us don't even begin to comprehend. She describes her new book as a love letter to the kind of strong, hardworking, down on their luck women who raised her. And my guest is Sarah Smarsh, so let me tell you a little about her. She's been on Conversations Live before with her first book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah's a journalist who's covered socioeconomic class, politics, and public policy for the New York Times, The Guardian, and The New Yorker. And she's a frequent speaker and commentator on economic inequality. Today, of course, we're discussing her new book, She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. And this is a fascinating look, literally, at the women who lived her songs. So here's my guest, Sarah Smarsh. Sarah Smarsh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Vicki.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you back because I loved your first book, Heartland, which was a National Book Award finalist, New York Times best-selling book, and it introduced us to your writing long form. So very pleased to have you back with this book we're talking about today, She Come By It Natural. But I want to just talk a little bit about the first book that we discussed because it challenged the typical male vision, if you will, of rural working class. It featured strong women who raised you and the poverty you grew up in. How has life changed for you since writing that book? Has the reaction to the book made you look at things any differently?
Well, thank you for that question about a book that in many ways I consider my life's work. I worked on that book for many years, and it took a long time to get agents and publishers to take notice. But once the moment was right and it entered the culture, I don't think I was necessarily surprised with anyone's reaction to it. I was, however, I suppose you could say, surprised at how much, good energy and blessings that it brought my way. So you asked how my life has changed since that book came out. When I was writing it in earnest for many years, mostly during my 20s while I was still in poverty, I hoped that someday someone might read it, but I didn't have any grand vision for the book. I just had a sense that I needed to write it. And in the couple of years since it's come out, prior to the COVID pandemic, was continuing to travel sort of nonstop because the appetite to discuss the themes in the book was so large. And so I've talked to broad swaths of very diverse groups of people about socioeconomic class and rural America, which the book really is about at its core. And happily also along the way, even though I'm always writing for the quote-unquote common man or woman, I've also been very fortunate to meet some luminaries and national figures who read and endorsed the book, and that's just been kind of an author's dream come true, I guess.
Yeah, most definitely. You want that story to continue and grow. And I suspect that people who read this new book will want to go back and read Heartland if they didn't catch it earlier. It was just a couple of years ago when we talked, I think. Was it about 2 years ago when it came out?
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. So let's look at book number two, just released. And I have to tell you, this was a surprise because I see Dolly Parton on the cover. The title, She Come By It Natural. And I thought, I admire Dolly Parton greatly because I've read a lot about her, seen a couple of biographies done about her. But did I want to talk about this? And then I started looking into the book and I was like, whoa, this is really not what I was expecting at all, and I really enjoyed it. So tell us in your own words how you describe the book.
Well, in one sense, it's kind of a love letter to the sort of woman who raised me, and you already referenced that in Heartland I was hoping to exalt a kind of a working class woman who often is invisible in a space where the narratives are dominated by men. And this book sort of follows in that vein, I suppose. This time, rather than it being an intergenerational family memoir, it's using an iconic figure in popular culture to examine the intersection between gender and class. So the reason this is of particular interest to me and why Dolly Parton would be the one who fits that bill for my writing's purposes is I was raised in a family and a culture where a lot of folks didn't finish high school, let alone go on to college. I was the first to do the latter. And that developed in me a real awareness, I suppose, of the different ways in which different classes of people are influenced, whether that's in the way of ideas or social progress or just information. And in a space like where I come from, what we might deem, you know, just somehow, I don't want to say unimportant, but a less important influence of culture or popular culture, which might even be diminished as banal in some spaces, was actually like the formative feminist text of my life, this the country music by strong women who had a lot in common with the women who raised me, and it was one of the very few places where I saw that type of woman or that archetype even validated and dignified in a really positive way.
Yeah, and, you know, growing up in England, I wasn't exposed to a great deal of that, but I think probably the first country song I remember was Stand By Your Man, Tammy Wynette. And and I remember my mother telling me, she goes, well, that's all well and good, but it doesn't apply in all circumstances.
Amen.
Yes, really. But then, of course, Dolly Parton came on the scene, and boy, I mean, she's had the most interesting life, I think. But this began for you as a four-part series. How did that come up?
Well, I was, speaking of Heartland again, I was on deadline for that book, so I had kind of finally gotten the much-awaited and hard-fought-for book deal, and I was, you know, on deadline to deliver that manuscript, which was a quite harrowing creative journey because that book is, in a lot of ways, involves the traumas of my life, as memoirs often do. And at that same moment, this was 2016, there was, of course, an incredibly fraught political election, presidential election going on in the United States, not unlike this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was seeing, you know, just pervasive in my own industry of journalism, just the repetition of a headline over and over that seemed to suggest that everyone from my place, in broadly speaking, rural America is by no means a monolith, and it's different in all places across the country, but broadly speaking, these headlines were insinuating over and over that a particular brand of conservative politics that doesn't represent me or the people who raised me was somehow synonymous with the rural experience and with the white working poor, and in fact that was the demographic that is completely to blame for the rise of that political faction. So that same year, Dolly Parton had a new album for the first time in a long time, and she was doing a big arena tour, and I was seeing people just kind of unify around her and love on her, all different types of people, groups that I didn't even know were Dolly fans. And it occurred to me, you know, while the worst of where I come from is front and center right now in the news, Dolly Parton, to my mind, represents the best of where I come from. She, of course, famously was raised in a poor holler in East Tennessee. And her grace and unconditional love and acceptance of all sorts of people just seemed like sort of a balm at that moment. And simultaneously, it occurred to me that, you know, just what I was saying a moment ago, that women like her were really my original feminist heroes, even though I didn't know the term feminist and I didn't grow up in a world where people were part of some sort of proper movement. So a magazine called No Depression, which is a great small publication that looks at roots in Americana music, had a fellowship that would allow a writer to spend a year digging in very deep to some way in which that music genre intersects with culture. And so I pitched this idea to them, and I happily got it. And so then I wrote this concurrently with Heartland in the final stretches of of that memoir's writing, and it was published over the course of 2017, and now happily it's a book a few years later.
Well, good for you for writing that series of articles, which became the book, and good for them for offering that fellowship. We need more of that stuff, because it's through good storytelling that we really understand or connect more with other people's stories. We can't do it just with facts and figures. It's through good storytelling.
Indeed.
So let's look at Dolly Parton as a woman, someone you describe as a rare sort of icon, full of paradox. On one hand, she was trashy, but at the same time, she has more class than most, you say. She dresses like a hooker, but she's family-oriented and self-proclaimed homebody. She's a giggly blonde who's smarter than, you know, many men she employs. There's so much about her that it's easy to dismiss because of the way she looks, but she's always been very conscious of that, right?
Yes, and I think that this might have been lost on her audience early on, or at the very least on the media, that she was very intentionally presenting the way that she does. And you can go back to some old interviews. There's a time in the 1970s when Dolly Parton was just kind of first setting out with a solo career, following some success as part of a country duet. And Barbara Walters interviewed her, and she really pressed her on her appearance and was sort of saying, well, don't you think you look silly? To some people, you look trashy. Why are you doing this? And she went so far as to say, don't you think that people laugh at you? It's actually quite uncomfortable interview to watch.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of classism, and I would say sexism, frankly, also going mm-hmm. on, which women can trade in as well. And Dolly says, well, I know people laugh at me, but the joke is on them, because I know exactly what I'm doing and I can change it at any time. And while that might have been seemed dubious at the moment when she was a young woman, I think that now, many decades later, we see what she's built and what she's done and how she has sustained in the industry and the iconic status she's achieved. Meanwhile, I think folks now kind of acknowledge unequivocally being a genius. I think that she was right, that the joke was on whoever was laughing at her.
Yeah, and I think there's a quote that you share in the book, and it's from 1990, so we're talking a while back. And Dolly said, if I have any charm at all, it's that I look totally phony, but I am totally real. That's my magic. And she really deeply understood that and has kept with it the whole time. I think of many celebrities where you see this this persona, you know, they're on stage, they're on camera, and then you'll see clips of them, you know, that go viral of them having temper tantrums and, you know, demeaning people. And I've never seen anything like that about Dolly Parton.
Yes, and I have to say, you know, I didn't set out to write this book because I was, you know, like a Dolly super fan.
Right.
There were some unique aspects of her celebrity that intrigued me, and you know, of course, I was a fan of her music. But I say that because I didn't go in, you know, with any intention to write basically hagiography, where I'm just, you know, unduly praising her. And if there had been, you know, nasty bits to reveal, I, as a journalist, would have, you know, where appropriate, revealed them. But by all accounts, and I don't think that you can pull this off for 50 years in show business if it isn't true, she's an incredibly kind person who is just as generous behind the scenes as she appears on stage and in her persona.
Yeah. So obviously she grew up, we've talked about this, in extreme poverty. And you say it was one thing to be a girl, another thing to grow up in poverty. But to be a girl who grew up in poverty and is still poor was basically not to be taken seriously. So how do you think she got people to take her seriously? How do you think she portrayed herself to the people that mattered in order for things to move forward for her?
Well, that's a great question, and the answer is somewhat complicated, I think, because, you know, this matter of being taken seriously, if you're a young blonde woman from East Tennessee with a quote-unquote hick accent and no formal education, one would think that a woman in her shoes would, you know, kind of adapt her, maybe try to lose her accent a little bit, or change the way that she dressed, or, you know, you might say class herself up, I guess.
Right.
And we know that she's a very smart woman, and she no doubt could have done those things if she had chosen to. But what she did, and here is the paradox that you were getting at before, is actually to really go in the opposite direction, like to an extreme, so that she took the symbols of basically, in many ways, female oppression, let's say high heels and makeup and all these things that when Dolly was a young woman, there was a movement going on where women were saying, wait a minute, why do we have to do this and men don't? We refuse to do this. And I, benefiting from the legacy of those women, say thank you. But I also find it fascinating that Dolly Parton went the opposite direction. She did those things to such an extreme that she became almost a caricature of, you know, the made up woman,
yeah,
who is a sexual object. But she did it before someone else could do it to her, which I think is the very clever move on her part. And it's why I talk of her as a sort of foremother of third wave feminism, where that's kind of a feature of the philosophy that you're so free, you're so liberated, that if you choose to wear high heels, even in the context of patriarchy, you do so. And so the reason that, to circle back to your question, I think this relates, is that garnered attention in a way that, unfortunately, perhaps her creative genius on its own might not have. And actually, when we talk about being taken seriously, in many ways, that is a to some extent, more recent phenomenon. She has been universally beloved for a very long time, and people have understood her powerful songwriting and her beautiful voice and so on for a long time. But the true apprehension of her, and understanding of the extent of her... she's an incredibly prolific songwriter. She's written, like, over 3,000 songs. She's,
oh, my gosh.
Turned out to be kind of, yes, and her business acumen is legendary. She's a juggernaut in philanthropy. There are all these things that were sort of quietly happening that she wasn't getting any attention for when people were making her, frankly, a boob joke, like when I was a kid in the 80s. And so there is a level at which, now that she's a woman in her 70s and hopefully society has progressed somewhat on gender, it's just now at this moment, and it's because she made those kind of chess moves as a young woman to make sure she got attention with the low-cut shirt, that now, and she's still in the spotlight and there to receive it, people are recognizing all of the many layers and depths underneath all that.
Right. So she's broken all these barriers in a patriarchal society and in a business world that, you know, is definitely patriarchal, although we're now, of course, having more women come forward. But she doesn't really consider herself a feminist, right?
That's right. You know, there have been some recent interviews where she's, you know, moved a little bit on in her relationship to that term, but by and large, you know, for a long time when that question was put to her in very direct terms, she would say flatly no. And you know, while I say in the acknowledgments of my book actually that the way I think this whole celebrity writing thing works is that or even discussion is that ultimately when someone is so iconic as Dolly Parton, she's sort of a mirror to all of us. And I'm very concerned with class and gender, and so these interpretations are mine, and I don't claim to know her heart and mind, but I do know, because I come from a place very like where she comes from, that there are a lot of strong, incredible women who, by my definition, are feminists through and through. They exquisitely live the tenets of feminism.
Yes.
And yet they are averse to the term, and it's because for a very long time some political factions have weaponized that term and created negative associations with it that result basically in a political discourse where we're not even all defining terms the same way, so discussion sort of breaks down. So I guess what I mean by that is, if Dolly Parton were defining feminism the way that I define it, I think she would happily embrace that term.
Yeah.
But I don't have any kind of self-satisfaction about my particular use of that term or understanding of it, because it's just a product of a very different life path, and that's true among me and some of the women who raised me, and that's why I wanted to make sure that women like them got their due.
Well, I have to agree with you. I think that term is often misused, and you know, as you said, people interpret it so many different ways. I've personally never liked the word myself, but that's because when I was growing up, boys' reaction to that were, oh, you're a lesbian, or you're a man hater, and you know, and of course nothing could be further from the truth on that, but so I was adverse to that from, you know, when I was a little girl. And certainly my grandmother and aunts and my mother, you know, wouldn't call themselves feminists, but every single one of them was out there strongly fighting for what they believed in. So
yes,
yeah, that's the key thing. You can call yourself what you like, but are you out there doing the work?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So one of the things that you know, artists do, it doesn't matter what, writers, painters, musicians, actors, they tap into that pain of their past to create their art. And of course, with many female country singers, their pain often rose from, you know, brokenheartedness and poverty, being poverty and being that second class citizen, if you will. And you say that Dolly's unique in this respect because she expresses herself with a special twist, with positivity and a smile, and understanding so deeply the connection of a difficult past and a blessed present. Would you just address that for us?
Sure. You know, and this, the first thing that jumped to mind when you were citing that reference in the book is that within the journalism industry, I've seen time and time again when I'm very often the only person in the room or the discussion who has any direct experience of poverty, that a very well-intentioned writer will, you know, go off into the trenches to write some story, and it always comes back like just absolutely wretched and miserable, and look at these poor people. And what is conveyed really is the writer's discomfort, pity maybe, and sometimes even condescension, frankly.
Yeah.
What I write in the book is that if you have lived in poverty yourself, you know that that experience is rich. It contains many struggles, but it also contains some particular freedoms. It includes tears, but also laughter. And what I admire so much about Dolly Parton is that she can, through her songs, and now we could say really her songwriting canon. She conveys all of those shades and tones, and the particular twist then is that often when she's telling the saddest story, she's presenting it sometimes with humor and sometimes with, you know, I would say the best word to sum it up would be gratitude. Her classic song, Coat of Many Colors, is a perfect example of this. So she's describing being shamed on the playground or at school for the rags that she's dressed in. And yes, that was true. And this is based on a true story, according to her. But the theme of the song actually is that this child who's being shamed is refuses to she doesn't take the coat off. Her mother made it for her with love, stitched together from scraps, and she's proud of it, and she remains proud of it. And she sort of strengthens up in opposition to the shaming, but all of this is told very gently, and I would say without even vilifying the kids who made fun of her. So that I think that spark of positivity, even in the face of extreme adversity, is one of the reasons that she is such a lasting artist and one who has such a broad audience, because it's a quite rare tact, I think, and it just comes from clearly who she is authentically and the way that she really does view the world.
Yeah, I saw her recently on Stephen Colbert. I don't know if you saw this, and she burst into a little song and he started crying. It was really sweet. And she describes herself as a song teller, term I've not really heard before, because she's telling her stories through her songs. And she's got a new book coming out too on that. So one of the things I think we should probably make clear in our conversation is you didn't actually talk with her, right? You researched her and that's correct, right? You didn't talk with her at all.
Yes, yeah, that's correct. I will say that I did badger her management when I first embarked on the project, and for whatever reason didn't land an interview. I've come to think that actually might have been a blessing for the writing, because I've interviewed a lot of celebrities in my day, but it might have been hard for me not to be dazzled. and she's such a an artful guest or interviewee, in a way that I guess what I'm saying is I'm glad that I didn't feel beholden to her in any way, because and this isn't really, I used the term celebrity writing a minute ago, and that isn't really what this is. I am using a public figure as a springboard to talk about bigger issues, and the other research that went into the book I think is probably more essential than a conversation with her.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And having, interviewed so many people myself, I can understand where you're coming from on that totally. So you've also shared a lot of your personal stories in there. Your grandmother, Betty, was very influential in your life. Do you have a favorite of your stories in this book?
The first story that pops to mind, and since we have been talking so much about Miss Barton, I guess I would share that my grandma is almost a precise contemporary of Barton's. They were born just a few months apart, and in many ways, my grandma lived the brutal, hard life through the decades that Barton herself was fortunate to escape, as they say. So basically, the songs that Dolly was writing early in her career that document the struggles of poor rural women, be that domestic violence or lack of access to reproductive health care and so on, sexism, of course. My grandma experienced all those things firsthand, and I couldn't have articulated this as a kid, of course, but I see it now in hindsight that, I was connecting with a kind of a parallel between the real woman in who was there in my farmhouse raising me and then the woman on in these records. And the reason I knew they had a direct connection is that I could count on one hand the number of times that I've seen my grandmother cry, where it's a very stoic German Catholic culture where we come from. And it was a tape in her car as we were going down a country highway on our way to who knows where, Dolly Parton tape, and that song, Coat of Many Colors, actually came on, and my grandmother cried, and I understood in a family, in a culture where there wasn't a lot of direct communication about feelings, her tears through that song and the lyrics that I paid very close attention to made me understand the extent to which poverty and shame had left its mark on my grandmother.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. How have you managed to stay productive during this chaotic time? I've talked to so many people who found it difficult. Have you found it difficult yourself?
First of all, I'm, you know, quite fortunate that I'm able to work from home. And so I certainly don't want to, you know, downplay the hard times that many people are experiencing, because I am very good at being a homebody and kind of nesting and going into my writer shell. I actually have, you know, happily been able to use some of that time for creative purposes. But gosh, it's a full-time job for any of us, I think, just to emotionally process everything that's happening. So no judgment if you're, like, sitting there scrolling through Twitter with a beer, because that is all that can be expected of anyone.
Yeah. I often ask this question of fiction writers, but rarely of non-fiction writers. But how did you go about writing the book? What was your process like for it? Did you do all your research first? Did you start writing? I mean, did you go down rabbit holes?
Yeah. Well, since as you mentioned earlier, I think that it was published in quarterly form as a serial for that magazine over the course of 2017. It has been lightly updated for book form, but. So because of the nature of those installments, it was kind of written in four chunks, just by way of how the deadlines unfurled. And there is a chronology about it. And then basically, you know, I divided that chronology kind of into four parts: her coming of age and her very early career, then her sort of coming into her own as a solo artist in part two. In part three, her, you know, kind of taking charge as a business mogul, really. And then in part four, finally, you know, completely elevated to status of icon. And for each of those sections, then, that kind of created a window to focus my research, because there's an incredible amount, of course, of archival content pertinent to Dolly Parton's life and career. And then basically I would steep myself in every bit of research I could find about those years in across very many formats. And I just sort of waited for a theme to arise. So I tend to write and think in sort of thematic chunks. So even though there is a chronological arc, it's really for what I see as the kind of meaning or driving force of a particular moment in her life and trajectory.
Yeah. Well, as I said in the introduction, you write about many topics, socioeconomic topics, about class, politics, public policy. And I wanted to ask you real quick about an article you wrote in The Guardian. And I'm going to quote from there. You say, if you want to stop authoritarianism, the efficient mission is not to attack the opposing side, but rather to stay firm in your principles and open in your heart. And I love that, which is why I wanted to end with it. And then you end the article by saying, the seed of everything you're fighting is inside you. Just highlight that for us, would you?
Sure. Well, you know, I am someone who fly my colors. Sometimes as a journalist, I am a progressive person who lives in a quote-unquote red state, and so there are a lot of battles to be had and a lot of arguments among, you know, people I've known for generations, families I see right before my eyes stretched thin over you know, political division, and that's of course increasingly true everywhere. And you know, what I think I might understand about this moment that some folks might not comes by way of my own political ideas changing during my lifetime. So I was raised in a, I would say, moderately conservative environment, and then my information sources changed when I went off to other places, and my peer group changed, and my lens on the world changed, and it, and so my views on all sorts of aspects of American politics changed. And it wasn't that I was a less decent person before. I should say, by the way, that I never had hate in my heart, and there is unfortunately a growing seed of hate, which is a completely different discussion. But if we're talking about people who in earnest want the best for this country and want an equal just society, and they differ on how to get that done, that conversation requires humility. And if you like me can look back on a previous version of yourself who saw things differently, even though she had the same, you know, good intentions in her heart, you have no choice but to approach a debate or conversation with, without just flatly vilifying or demonizing the other side. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't completely denounce an idea, but what I'm suggesting is, even if your ideas are superior to someone else's, that you consider that perhaps it's not because you yourself are superior. It's because of the path that you've walked and the experiences that perhaps you've been privileged to have.
Very good. Very good. And informed by everything you've been through and everything you've written about. I love that. Well, Sarah Smash, always such a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate your time today, and I know listeners can find out much more about you at sarahsmash.com. The name of the book, of course, is She Come By It Natural, Dolly Parton and the Women Who Lived Her Songs. And a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Sarah.
A final thought. Well, I think that one word that best describes the subject of my new book, that subject being Dolly Parton, would be grace, and not in any religious sense, I don't think, but just in the sense of rising to, you know, your highest function as an ethical being. And these are hard times when, if you're just watching headlines and taking in the news, you might think that. Gosh, why don't we all just throw up our hands and stop trying? I would encourage folks, regardless of what you're reading or thinking about, to consider that virtue of grace that is so lacking in our political discourse and among our public leaders. And if you can bring that forth in yourself somehow, that's doing good, important work for fixing what ails our society.
Perfect. One person at a time, right? One person at a time.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today. Really appreciate you spending this time with us. You can hear my previous conversation with Sarah on her first book, Heartland, at conversationslive.net, which, of course, where this will be posted to. And we will see you next week. Until then, live well, stay strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.